one now with a pair of Spartans. She did her best to stifle her smile. "Why doesn't this warthog have a weapons mount in the back?" Molly asked Lucy, who was driving. "Takes up too much space. This format's for scouting and transport. We sometimes risk going weaponless to be able to move more stuff, or to have a lower energy profile." Molly reflected on that for a moment. This vehicle was designed from the ground up for war, but with its weapon removed, it was significantly less threatening. It still looked and operated like a warthog, but it became a means of transportation rather than a tool to kill things. In a strange way, it reminded her of Bakaar. The Sangheili built their people from the ground up for war, but he had refused that path. He didn't desire to follow his father or brother on their own campaigns, but rather to carve his own destiny, one that didn't involve bloodshed or the suffering of others, even at great cost to himself. For the first time, Molly felt like she got Bakaar. The warthog drove out to an area on the edge of Paxopolis that looked like nothing more than a large hill. Given how flat the rest of the city was, Molly thought that this might have been where the construction crews had moved the dirt when they'd leveled the rest of the place. Maybe it had been just that originally, but it had now been put to better use. A thick layer of grass covered the hill, but as they drew closer, Molly could see windows poking through the tall blades, dozens of them scattered all over the hilltop. The warthog followed the road around to the far side of the hill and came to a halt in front of a circular door. The door irised open as the warthog came to a stop, and a male Ungoy came waddling out as fast as his legs would take him. "Gadam, I'm so pleased you're not dead." "It's all right, Papa Marfo." She climbed down the side of the warthog to the ground. "I wasn't in any danger at all." She stopped herself short, realizing she was maybe stretching the truth. "Well, not in any real danger. If that was the case, I'd already be dead, right?" The older Ungoy swept her up into his arms and gave her a tight hug. "I've been trying to convince your mamas about schooling you here in the hovel permanently. I know that you do not want that, but you are not helping your case, little one." He set Gadam down and gave her a little nibble on the top of her head, which Molly took to be some show of parental affection. Then Marfo turned toward the warthog and spotted Molly and Karim on the bed. "You must be the two humans who helped my little Gadam in that fight against those bullies the other day. I've heard so much about you, and I am so pleased to meet you. Can't you join us for dinner?" Molly swallowed hard, having completely forgotten about the offer earlier. "We don't have time for that right now," Lucy said to the Ungoy. "The entire region's about to go under lockdown." Marfo's face fell. "Oh, that's too bad. How long do we think that might last?"
"Until we find the ones who attacked the repository today," said Tom. "Could be hours. Could be days. It's for your own safety, sir."
"I heard a rumor that they were from the servants of the Abiding Truth," the young boy spit on the ground. "Haven't they done enough to us already? Why can't they just leave us alone?"
"We'll find them," Lucy said, "and we will stop them."
"I hope you do," Marfo said. "And I hope you use bullets."
Tom and Lucy exchanged a knowing look at the comment and then bid the Ungoy goodbye before taking off for the city proper. As they drove through town, the vehicle blew past all sorts of buildings and businesses being shut down and locked up in the center of Paxopolis, as though a major storm was about to roll through. Molly turned to Karim.
"You mentioned that your mom studied Ungoy culture. That's why you came here to Onyx. What did she do before that?"
"You mean as a career?"
"I mean before alien cultures became a thing people could study. She worked in the Navy. She was a combat doctor during the war."
"From what I hear, she was a good one, too," Tom said from the front passenger seat.
She did some research for Oni on the Ungoy anatomy and medical profile toward the end of the war, and eventually became something of an expert on their culture. And that led to Onyx.
What about you? He asked Molly. How do you get here?
Molly didn't respond for several seconds, unsure what she was willing to share with Kareem, and what she wanted to keep to herself.
It's okay. You don't have to answer, he said with reassuring eyes.
No, it's fine. My parents and sister died on Paris IV when the Covenant attacked. I was one of the only survivors. I was 7. My parents' friends, Asha and Yong, adopted me. They've been working on Forerunner stuff since, well, longer than I can remember.
Sorry about your loss, Kareem said with full sincerity. I suppose that explains why you hate other species so much.
Hate? Molly asked, surprised by his charge.
Why do you think I hate them?
Is that why you're so friendly with Bakar and Gudam? To compensate for me? Kareem snorted at that.
Not at all. Have you noticed how everyone else at the school treats them? Even the other members of their species. Most don't want to be caught dead with them.
So you have to be the one to be better than that, right?
Why not?
Molly couldn't think of a thing to say to that. He was right, although she hadn't given it a lot of thought. Ever since the self-defense classes the Spartans had begun, her appreciation for Gadam and even Bakar had grown, without her noticing. Today had confirmed that. Although she still found herself reluctant to embrace it, Molly had somehow wound up with friends. Real friends. Alien friends. All right. Friends of other species. But wow. The warthog reached Kareem's house a moment later, and his mother came out to greet them. She was thin, with big eyes and a fiercely sharp look, much like Kareem. She also shared his curly dark hair. Once he climbed down the side of the warthog, she gathered him into an embrace and didn't let go for a long moment.
I'm okay, Mom. Seriously. Your father's on his way home.
She took Kareem's face in both her hands and gazed into his eyes, looking for any signs of something.
Damage? Fear?
The concern in her face reminded Molly of her own mom, and the way she'd held her hand in the car on that last day. She shrugged the memory off as the warthog peeled away. Molly lived only a couple blocks away from Kareem, but the Spartans insisted on bringing her all the way there.
Orders are orders, Lucy said. Besides, we need to have a word with your parents.
That made sense. Spartans, especially the ones helping manage security on the most important research site in human history, probably had 1,000 more important things to do than escort a handful of children back home during lockdown. Whatever it was that Molly's new parents were working on, though, it rated high on the list of Oni's concerns. The Spartans weren't babysitting. They were making sure nothing else happened that might distract Asha or Yong from their work. Not even for a second. When the warthog finally pulled up in front of Molly's house, Yong was just walking onto the porch from work. He turned around and trotted out to the warthog, helping Molly down from the vehicle. He pulled her close and held her in a tight embrace for a few seconds before saying anything.
So glad to see you safe, kiddo, he finally said before turning to Tom and Lucy.
Thanks for bringing her home.
It was our pleasure, Tom said with an easy smile. It's not every day we get to cart around a real hero in the back of a warthog.
Molly grinned at that as Yong gave her another hug.
Is Asha home as well? Lucy asked.
Director Mendez wanted me to make sure to have the two of you check in with him as soon as you're locked down here.
I just pulled up and haven't had the chance to check. You don't think what happened today had anything to do with what we're studying?
That's above our pay grade, Tom said.
but you should give it some thought. Has it shown any signs of activity yet? Yong shook his head. No, not yet. Not for the last 100,000 years, at least. Well, we've got orders to increase the level of security around the site, Lucy said. Just in case there's a connection we're not aware of. We'll make sure to notify you and Asha if we need to get you out there. Till then, stay put where we can reach you. After the Spartans drove away, Molly and Yong walked up the porch stairs and into the house, where they found Asha coming down the stairs. She wasn't quite as calm about the entire affair as Yong, it seemed. Asha grabbed Molly and refused to let go. Yong guided them to the living room couch, and the three of them sat down on it. Not until that moment did Molly realize just how shaky she still was. Maybe it was fatigue. Maybe it was just because of the way Asha looked at her, with dread in her eyes. It was beginning to hit home. Molly had almost died today. Director Mendez told me everything, Asha said while she held Molly. You're lucky you didn't get killed. At least none of the children were hurt, Yong said. He brought Molly a cool drink and sat down next to them, putting his arms around them both. We would have been if Kasha hadn't drawn that thing away from us, Molly said. She's the real hero. Really? You? Saying kind things about a Sangheili? Yong said. That's some progress. Asha shot daggers at him with her eyes. This is not the time for that. Come on, I was complimenting her, Asha. I'm proud of how far she's come. She's learning to get along with other species. That's incredible to me. She was in real danger today, Yong. Trust me. I know. He reached across Molly and put a hand on Asha's knee, and she helped to save her headmaster and the rest of the students in her class. I'm in awe of her. Well, I'm not. Asha pulled back, and Molly could finally see the tears running down her face. What's wrong? I'm fine. Asha was tough, and Molly had rarely ever seen her cry. I know. Asha wiped her face dry. I know. It's just that I want you to be safe, Molly. That's the whole reason we brought you here. I didn't want you to have to worry about this kind of stuff anymore. But even this place isn't immune to it. Molly didn't know what to say. Asha was right. Onyx wasn't as safe as they'd thought it would be. No one could have expected Sangheili terrorists to find a way in. But they had. I could barely deal with living in Aranuka, Asha continued. Every day we were there, everything I saw reminded me of the war, of how the Covenant had almost taken away all that we had. After what happened to you on Paris IV, I just wanted to make sure nothing like that could ever hurt you again. I'm sorry, Molly. I know you didn't want to come here. Molly leaned into her and held her tight. It's all right. I'm not upset about Onyx anymore. It was the right thing to do, coming here. You guys were right. Oni needs you here. And to be honest, I need to be here too, she said, almost surprising herself. And no place in the galaxy is perfectly safe, right? At least here, there's a much smaller chance of being hit by a car while crossing the street. Asha actually laughed at that. I know just how you feel, Asha, Yong said to her softly. I question the decision to come here too, just about every day. But we're here now, and we're doing something important. Something that could save lives. Humanity needs us here. He's right, Molly said. We belong here. She surprised herself by how much she really meant it. Maybe it was the trauma from all that had happened that day. But she felt more bonded,
more connected to Onyx than she ever had to Aranuka. They weren't just sitting on the sidelines out here, staring up at the sky and hoping that no one would come raining fire down on them. They were right in the heart of things, and they were going to make a difference. Well, her new parents were. Molly was just going to try to steer clear of any more trouble and survive. Or so she hoped.
Chapter 19. Tom B-292 shook his head as he examined the bodies strewn about. "We can't stick around here forever," he said to the forensics team. "The creatures who killed all these people might come back." The leader of the team, Lieutenant Chow, cocked her head at Tom and flashed him a sardonic smirk. "You telling me there's something out there a pair of Spartans can't handle?" "There are hundreds of planets worth of things out there," Lucy B-091 said to Chow. "Creatures the Forerunners imported from countless worlds. You tell me what the odds are that we can take down them all." The smile faded from Chow's face, and she set to urging the people under her command to work faster. They were not only cataloging the data from the scene, but bagging up the bodies to bring them back to Trevelyan, and it was slow, painstaking work. They could only hustle it along so much, Tom knew, but he wished they could manage more. It didn't make sense to him to risk the living for the dead. Lucy, who'd been watching over the people working inside the Forerunner structure, pinged Tom. When he glanced her way, he spotted her in the structure's main doorway, and she motioned for him to follow her. He scanned the horizon all the way around them before he moved after her. The Spartan didn't like leaving the place's exterior unwatched. Mendez had deployed the two Spartans and a small recovery team to a remote Forerunner site that had recently gone offline. After the events at the repository, the director had suspicions about the source of the incursion, and this particular site was on his list. It wasn't just the creatures. Lucy escorted Tom into the structure. "See these blast marks along the walls? Sangheili weapons? You don't get those kinds of splotches from bullets." Tom frowned at the scorch marks. Mendez was right. This has to be connected to the portal we found being used at the repository. How could it not? Chow interrupted their conversation to report. Her brow was furrowed with a mixture of confusion and concern. "We found a few spots of Sangheili blood here, mixed in with the rest." "But no Sangheili bodies?" She shook her head. "And no Sangheili were authorized to be out here at the time. The team assigned to be working here was 100% human." Tom frowned at that. Not good news. At Lucy's insistence, Tom followed her deeper into the structure. There she showed him a large Forerunner portal that stood deactivated. "There are Ruffacrete tracks leading up to it." She pointed to odd patterns on the floor, faintly stamped in crimson blood. "Any coming out?" Tom figured he already knew the answer, but he had to ask. Lucy gave him a grim shake of her head. He stared at the portal, inspecting it. It looked like a massive doorway that opened onto nothing. "It's dead enough now. How'd they turn it on?" Lucy shrugged. "Never seen anyone but a Huragok work one of these things."
"That's simple then," Chow called from back down the hallway. She'd been listening in from a comfortable distance. "How's that?" Tom asked.
"Must have had a Huragok to help them out."
Much as it turned Tom's stomach, it was the only thing that made sense. He tapped his comm. "Chief?" Mendez answered with a sigh.
"Yes.
I think we've got mice."
"Speak plainly, son."
Tom hesitated.
"Are all our Huragok accounted for?"
"Hold on."
Mendez came back on a moment later. "Every last one.
Any of them somehow wound up out on our current location at any point?"
Another pause.
"Not according to the tracking system."
"Are you requisitioning one?"
Lucy shrugged.
"Could a Huragok lock down the portal system so that no other Huragok could open it?"
"I don't know." I don't think that's something that's come up before, Mendez said. All of the Huragok inside Onyx have always been under our control.
Tom gazed at the dead gate. I don't think that's the case anymore.
Chapter 20. The hope Molly had for staying out of trouble didn't last long following the repository incident from the week before. Everything went to hell in October. When the UNSC failed to find the servants of the Abiding Truth inside Onyx after 24 hours of intensive scanning that turned up nothing, or at least nothing they were willing to share with the general population, they lifted the lockdown on all Paxopolis and Pax Institute facilities. The city was still on a high security alert, and its citizens were advised to keep an eye out for any signs of activity that could be connected to the servants. Given the size of Onyx, that they hadn't found anything wasn't terribly surprising, but it did raise a lot of questions. Meanwhile, Oni closed down the repository and a number of other portal-adjacent sites until they could figure out a way to ensure the safety of anyone working there. That meant moving around all the people who'd been assigned to a given site, including the Huragok, who now found themselves on other low-risk duties. For the Huragok who was present at the repository during the attack, that included, apparently, working at the Pax Institute from time to time. One day, when Molly and the others were waiting for Tom and Lucy to show up for a self-defense class, the Huragok arrived instead. It just floated right into the room and spoke to them in an electronic voice. I am prone to drift. I am speaking to you through a translator that I built. I operate it via the cilia on the ends of my tentacles. It was a strange way for it to introduce itself, but Molly found it disarmingly honest. She was curious if this was how the Huragok talked to everyone or just her. She peered underneath the creature and saw that it was doing just as it said, using one of its six tentacles to manipulate a glass-faced datapad mounted to its underbelly. I was not created with the ability to vocalize thoughts, as that is an inefficient means of communication. For communication among Huragok, that is. When I must talk to humans, however, it is required. So I designed this system. Kareem walked all the way around the creature, taking it in from every angle. Amazing. Prone ignored him entirely, as if it knew exactly how amazing it was. I am here to inform you that Spartan Tom B-292 and Spartan Lucy B-091 will not be able to make it to your meeting today. Their duties require them to be elsewhere.
They could have just sent us a message about that, Bakar said, suspicious and seemingly unimpressed with the engineer's communication innovation.
I was coming to the school to make some improvements and repairs, and they knew that I wanted to meet you. That made this not an either-or decision, but a both-and decision.
Are you the Huragok who is in the repository? Kadam said. I so wanted to meet you, but they bundled us into the transport and got us out of there so fast we never had the chance. My papa worked with Huragok during the war, and he always has great things to say about you. How smart you are, and how pleasant you smelled to him.
Molly wasn't exactly sure what Papa Marfo smelled when he was near a Huragok, but it was clear to her that they had radically different ideas of what qualified as pleasant.
I was in the repository when it was attacked. I understand you four helped distract the creature that killed several people there before Mike Spencer could remove it. For that, I want to express my gratitude.
We did not do it to save you, Bakar said, as though he was ready to stop wasting time.
You're welcome, Molly said to the Huragok as she shot Bakar a look.
What are you working on here? Kareem said.
I am charged with updating and improving the security of this facility. I plan to work after the school day is over, so as to minimize any disruption my presence may cause. Communication to facilities outside the sphere has been difficult. After I am finished here, I will tune the city's primary communications relay, located at the center of the Citadel, Molly knew exactly what Prone to Drift was talking about. The news feeds had been filled with all sorts of reports about troubles in the colonies. That was nothing new. It seemed to be an exacerbation of what Molly had discussed with Young and Asha, possibly connected to their work on the sphere. This wasn't the first time in UNSC history that there had been comms trouble between worlds. The colonies and the unified Earth government had been at odds since way before the Covenant War started, and now that the war was over, they were back at it again, in some places worse than ever. Fighting near key planetary relays cropped up and would often sever communication for days and even weeks. This time, however, the colonies were reporting disasters that didn't seem to have anything to do with rebels. Entire worlds were going quiet all at once, with no one responding from them at all. This didn't fit the profiles of a civil conflict, and its effect spanned so wide, it was clear that the UNSC didn't have an adequate response in place. For Molly, the whole thing was disconcerting. At first, the regular news sites treated it tentatively, not entirely confident what they were reporting. They insinuated that it was probably just some kind of trouble with slipspace communications relays. The opinion sites let fly conspiracy theories of all kinds. Some claimed that slipspace pollution from humanity's heightened use of Forerunner technology had taken out the colonies and was bound to doom them all. Others believed this was the harbinger of a coalition of colonies gathering a massive navy, able to challenge the UNSC and take over Earth. Molly hadn't forgotten her conversation with Asha and Young, though. These blackouts probably had something to do with Project Goliath. Had to be. But what was more concerning for Molly was that Bakar's brother, Dural, was evidently still running around inside Onyx with who knew what kind of weapons on hand. Not to mention however many Sangheili were with him from the servants of the Abiding Truth. How did they get into Onyx, and what are they after? Molly wondered. Why haven't the Spartans been able to track them down yet? Are the servants just biding their time, preparing to strike? Or are they planning something else? All of these questions occupied Molly's thoughts most days. And she wasn't the only one. At school, chatter about the incident at the repository didn't let up. As far as Molly knew, most of the other students had no idea about the presence of the servants, much less Bakar's true identity and his relationship to Dural. They may not have even known who the servants were. Despite that, most of the students were scared. None of them had expected to have their lives imperiled after moving into the most secure location in the galaxy. Now they were learning a hard truth, even in a refuge such as Onyx. No one was truly safe. For Molly, Gadam, Kareem, and Bakar, the effect of the repository event was entirely positive. Dozens of other students kept thanking the four of them for their bravery that day. Taken off guard by how a bunch of no-name outsiders had responded under pressure, the students were treating them like heroes, and for a moment, Molly almost bought into it. After mulling over the situation for a few days, however, she realized Asha was right. They weren't heroes. They were silly kids who got caught up in something way over their heads that could have ended with them all getting killed. They had just been incredibly lucky that day. Prone to Drift agreed with that view. "I am impressed with you four," the Huragok said, escorting the group from the gym. "Because of what happened at the repository?" Kareem asked. "Yes, but not due to your actions. Those were foolish. Given the probabilities in question, it is remarkable that you survived." "Why then?" Molly wondered. "You four impress me, because you embody what this city has been about from the beginning. Unity. Given all that has happened in your species' past, the fact that you four are bonded as friends and allies is the real marvel. The Forerunners created places like this shield world to preserve biodiversity. You honor their work with your actions. The Huragok's profound statement hit Molly hard. Thank you, prone to drift, she said. There is no need for formality anymore, Molly Patel. The Huragok craned its neck to stare at her with its six eyes. You four can call me prone. One night after dinner, Director Mendez came over to consult with Molly's parents, and she managed to discreetly listen in from the kitchen. Evidently, the Covenant had set up shop on a planet known as Kamchatka, a world that had something to do with the Forerunners. Molly's new parents had apparently known the location. The Covenant forces were hunting for something left behind by the Forerunners, and Mendez was concerned it might have something to do with Project Goliath. After assessing the data he shared, Asha and Young agreed with the possibility, but they weren't entirely convinced. Later that night, Molly spent a few hours scanning the news feeds for more details about what Mendez was referring to, but nothing came up. That didn't mean it hadn't happened, just that the director had access to far better information than the media. She would have been shocked if she'd found anything at all, given Oni's involvement. Still, the questions that hung out there bothered Molly. What made things worse was that she knew her new parents were at the center of it. During one of her self-defense lessons with Lucy and Tom a few days later, Molly asked them if there were any updates about their efforts to find the servants of the Abiding Truth. This was in the middle of a fistfight between her and Bakar. The four students had begun sparring a few weeks earlier. It was challenging at first, but as they progressed, Molly found herself more and more confident, even against a Sangheili who did not understand what it meant to go easy. Nothing new on that front, Tom said as Bakar threw a punch at her that she narrowly blocked. But we're obviously not giving up. Are you sure they didn't leave or something? Karim asked while he dodged a kick from Gadam. I mean, they did kind of break their way into this place, right? They could have broken out. It's possible they fled, said Lucy. But that's not the most pressing issue. Like you said, those Sangheili warriors got in here somehow. Even if they're gone, we need to figure out how they managed to breach the exterior, so we can secure the sphere. Otherwise, they could hypothetically show up in any part of Onyx at any moment. What about the Huragok? Molly asked. The ones who were made for Onyx. Don't they have a way to know where the breach is? Yes and no, Tom said, somewhat displeased that they'd ground the training session to a halt. Onyx is a pretty big place, right? They can monitor a lot of it, but most is out of their reach, and the network was never completely finished. During the height of the Forerunners, apparently there had been thousands of Huragok here, but we only have a handful, who were largely focused on a very small sliver of all that Onyx is. That said, entry to this world should have already been barred, which means the servants found an exploit of some kind. Do you not have any leads at all? Bakar asked. The Sangheili was still hard to read, but not with regard to the servants. He got agitated every time the subject came up. Molly took advantage of that to catch him with a backhand to his gut. Lucy shrugged. I didn't say that. The Huragok have been trying to trace them through the portal network. We have some clues, but nothing definitive. I'm going to go check a few of them out in person tomorrow. We'll see what turns up. Now, no more questions. Let's get back to training. That night, Asha and Young took Molly aside with a data pad and showed her a memo they'd gotten from Director Barton. It reported that a team of Spartans had infiltrated Kamchatka during a battle between the Covenant and hostile Forerunner defenses, protecting what they were after. During the operation, the Spartan team had found and killed the leader of the Covenant, Jewel M'Dama. In other words, Bakar's father was dead. Molly hadn't told her new parents about who Jewel M'Dama was to Bakar yet. She hadn't told anyone.
Most Oni personnel inside Onyx probably knew about Bakar's relationship to Umdama, but few other people in Paxopolis did.
I need to tell Bakar, Molly said.
If it's appropriate, I'm sure Kasha will let him know, Young said. Or Director Mendez. This stays between us. The only reason we showed it to you is so you're not going into school blind.
Is this reported by the Sangheili news feeds? Molly asked.
Young made a quick scan of the major Sangheili sources on his datapad. He shook his head as he went.
Nothing, he said after a moment.
At least not yet.
The Sangheili don't have the same kind of information structure we have, Asha said.
And much of Sanghelios is a war zone right now. The Arbiter's too busy actually fighting against the Covenant in his own backyard to worry about propagating that news.
And Oni's likely keeping a tight lid on the information, too, Young said. If it hadn't involved Kamchatka, I doubt they would have let us in on this. It's only because of what they found there. What the Covenant had been after. It's one of the Forerunner machines we talked about earlier. The thing we were brought here to research. Except, on Kamchatka, the machine actually activated.
Activated? Molly thought as her chest grew tighter. What does that mean?
She wanted to press Young further, but Asha cut her off.
And we wouldn't share any of this if we didn't know that it's safe with you, Asha said.
This is classified, Molly, so keep it to yourself.
If others knew about the connections here, that'd cause a lot of people to be really concerned, and it could ultimately hamper our ability to help.
But why are you so worried about Bakar?
It seems like something he'd want to know.
More than likely. He'll know before school tomorrow, Asha said.
Kasha would not keep this from him. No reason for you to head out to the Sangheili Keep over this.
The thought of going to the Sangheili Keep, which sat on the opposite side of Paxopolis from the Ungoy Burrow, made Molly instantly uneasy. That was still a good ways off from what she felt comfortable with. It was one thing to be in the same class with aliens, even to be friends with some, but something completely different to go to the place they called home.
Molly went back up to her room and lay on her bed restlessly for a full hour. She couldn't shake the info she'd just learned.
Bakar's father is dead.
Any hope he might have had for peace about his father or reconciliation was gone.
Forever.
Molly knew what that felt like, and it made her sympathy for Bakar even stronger. Eventually, she gave up wrestling with it. She grabbed her datapad and tried to contact Bakar over the Pax Institute's messaging system. She hadn't gotten much use out of it yet, other than to get assignments from her teachers, but it was the only connection she had to Bakar at the moment. She pinged him on it.
Molly, did you hear the news?
About the fighting on Kamchatka? There was no response for over an hour. She finally gave up and was about to go to sleep when she got a ping back.
Bakar. I have now.
Molly.
Are you okay?
Bakar. Of course I am. Molly thought about just accepting that and talking to him about it in the morning, but she couldn't let it lie.
Molly. What about your father?
Bakar. I have been dead to him for a long time. Now I can say the same about him.
Molly, I'm sorry for your loss. I know what it's like to be an orphan.
Bakar, I was orphaned the day my mother died. This changes nothing.
Then he signed off the system.
Molly stared at the screen for a few minutes, wondering what to make of it. Her story and Bakar's were certainly different, but both of them had now lost their parents. That made her feel closer to him than she had before. When Molly saw Bakar at school in the morning, they didn't talk about it. But at lunch in the dining hall, Karine delicately brought it up.
I shed no tears for my uncle, Bakar said, refusing to use the word father.
How do Sangheili grieve? Molly wondered. Do they memorialize their dead? Do they weep?
Looking at Bakar's impassive face across the table, Molly wondered if he even had the physical ability to do so.
I don't blame you, Karim said. Your uncle was... well, you know, all too well. There was a time when I respected him, much as I thought of all my uncles in our keep. When he took up arms against the Arbiter with the servants, when my mother died looking for him, he lost that respect. Still, I admit I took some comfort knowing that he was yet alive. I have heard nothing of my keep for many years now. For all I know, it was brought to ruin in the war. Given the actions of my uncle, I could hardly blame the Arbiter for that, if so. In any case, I thought perhaps Jewel was my only living relative. Now, there is only Dural.
Wouldn't it have been better to know that he was your father when you were living in that keep with him?
Gadam asked softly.
How proud you would have been of him. And you would have been next in line to be the Kaidan, right? Or would it have been your older brother?
Bakar snorted at that. Neither. The reason we keep knowledge of our lineage secret, from both fathers and sons, is exactly to prevent any sort of handing down of power from one generation to the next. To become Kaidan, I would have to prove myself to be the most worthy, just as he did, and his uncle before him. And that would never have happened.
Why not? Molly asked.
I do not have what is required to become Kaidan, and I never have. I am too weak, they tell me. And I suppose I proved them right about that. I don't savor combat or seek glory from war as they do. I would rather pursue peace and apply our people's effort toward things that build up our society, not tear it down. Besides, if my father had been willing to groom anyone to take over his position, it would have been Dural. He was older, for one, and he was much more like Jewel in so many respects.
And you? Asked Karim.
I favored our mother.
Me too, said Karim.
I never really knew my birth dad.
Did you lose him in the war? Molly asked.
Karim shook his head. Divorced my mom early on. Left Earth for the colonies when I was still in diapers. Haven't heard from him since.
Sorry.
Molly didn't exactly know what to say.
Karim shrugged it off. It had been a fact of life for him for so long. He didn't know any different.
We heard about your parents, Gadam said, now looking at Molly. I'm sorry about them, too.
The unexpected sympathy caught her off guard. For a moment, she didn't know how to respond.
I think that's the fewest words I've ever heard you string together, she said to Gadam, trying to deflect. I am sorry as well, Bakar said, his Sangheili eyes staring directly into hers, for your loss.
You didn't have anything to do with it.
Molly surprised herself with how sincere that statement felt. She knew two things in that moment. That Bakar wasn't to blame for her parents' deaths. And that Bakar truly was her friend. The next few days passed by quickly. Lucy took off on the brief mission she had mentioned. But Molly, Karim, Gadam, and Bakar kept training with Tom. The lessons became more intense. They never knew if or when Tom might be called away as well, and they desperately wanted to learn as much as they could before that happened. Something told Molly that things were coming to a head. The urgency they felt now hadn't been present when they'd first started these training sessions. It felt as if fate had drawn the four of them here, because they were bound to need such skills. Sometimes they would test Tom's ability to keep a secret by prodding him about the servants of the abiding truth. Some analysts inside Oni apparently believed the servants were plotting something in retaliation for Jewel Ndama's death, due to Dural's relation to him. Others said their forces had gone into hiding, biding their time until they were afforded another opportunity to strike. No matter how many people they sent looking for them, though, in a place as big as Onyx, the UNSC had almost no chance of finding them. When Molly's new parents weren't home, she found herself rooting through the files on one of their unsecured datapads. It was wrong, and she knew she shouldn't have done it, but her curiosity had simply become too strong for her to ignore, especially given what had happened to Bakar's father. The information on the datapad wasn't about their work, so she felt she could rationalize peeking at it. Some of the memos on the datapad revealed that whatever was left of Ndama's covenant had, as of only a few days ago, launched an assault on Sanghelios. As the covenant forces pressed harder, whatever assets they had left on the planet had risen up against the Arbiter in a last-ditch attempt to overthrow him. Word that Sanghelios had erupted into global war had leaked out into the general press. While skirmishes had occurred there for years now, including battles for land and rights among various keeps and states, this was the first time the term global war was being used in conjunction with Sanghelios. Then, it happened. On October 27th, 2558, Ndama's covenant made a final attempt to assassinate the Arbiter, but failed. While the covenant attempted to recover, the swords of Sanghelios launched a full offensive against the city of Sunion, the last major stronghold for Jewel Ndama's forces. This was their one chance to put an end to Ndama's work of resurrecting the Covenant. And it worked. The Covenant, as humanity knew it, had been destroyed. That same evening, Molly heard Asha and Young gasping over something that Director Barton had sent them. She peeked through the doorway and over their shoulders at the screen they were viewing. From what Molly could tell, it was footage from the final battle between the Arbiter's forces and those of the Covenant. The angle and perspective made the action difficult to follow, but she could see why Barton had sent it to them. During the battle, something had risen out of the Sanghelios Ocean. Something of critical importance to Young and Asha's work on Onyx. The gigantic robotic stood something like a kilometer and a half high. The enormous thing, vaguely shaped like a bird, had vast wings that hung down at its sides as it rose. At its center was something that resembled a stern face. It must have been a forerunner machine of some kind. Its gigantic pieces just floated next to each other, as if they were connected by invisible magnetic bonds. Yet it somehow also exuded the impression that it was a living creature. The machine's individual parts were silver and laced with bright blue lights that coursed with energy. Once it reached a certain height, the machine stopped rising, and the parts of it that appeared to be wings began arcing out of its back as if it were some kind of avenging angel. Then the footage stopped cold, and the feed went blank. "That's it," Young said. "That's one of ours, same as the others. And Asha," he gaped at her, "it's active."
"What do you mean?"
"What's active?" Molly asked, still peeking from the doorway. They would either deflect and usher her out of the room or answer her question, she figured. She had nothing to lose. "All right," Young said, instantly coming to terms with what Molly had seen and trading an excited but somber look with Asha. "You've already seen it, so we might as well explain." "Remember what we told you about Project Goliath?" Asha started. "Well, this machine is part of what we've been tracking for years. We've seen a number of these things in our studies, but never an active one. Some of them were buried in so much rock that they were impossible for us to study. We weren't sure what their original function was. With the report from Kamchatka, and now this one, it proves a theory we've been considering. Something we came up with literally years ago."
"What was that?" Molly asked.
"First, that the Forerunners buried these things to hide them, which means they didn't want those who came later to know they existed,"
Asha explained. And since the Forerunners didn't destroy them, it's clear they planned for them to be used. This meant that they could become active at some point, Young said, and cause a great amount of damage. Based on a variety of signals being transmitted to and from the machines, it was pretty clear to us that they weren't deactivated, but had simply been placed in a standby mode. These machines were dormant for 100,000 years, Asha continued, a grave look on her face. And now, one by one, they're coming alive. The new parents explained that from the reports they had been poring over, the Sanghelios construct had been slumbering under the waters of Sonion for the entire history of the Sangheili people. For Asha and Yong, the most intriguing part was that the construct hadn't shown any signs that it was affected by the battle taking place around it. It had simply stood watch over it for a time, only defending itself when anything happened to attack it. But otherwise it hadn't done anything, at least until the very end. According to the after-action report, the machine had released a series of pulses that traumatically affected the landscape around it, causing earthquakes and landslides. After it was done wreaking havoc on everything and everyone nearby, it had opened up a rift into slipspace and simply disappeared. Molly was shaken by the whole revelation, and the fact that her new parents didn't have clear answers about what to expect next bothered her even more. It seemed likely that the colonies that had blacked out recently had similar machines awakening on them as well. It all had to be connected. She found it even more disturbing that one of these very machines was here on Onyx, and it was the focus of Asha and Young's relentless work. Will that one awaken soon as well? How long do we have before things go really bad? Molly spent the rest of the evening struggling to sleep. Eventually, she gave up and sat in her bed, just thinking until morning. Although some of the things she'd seen in the video feed were completely secret, the news of the Arbiter's victory over the Covenant leaked out overnight and spread like wildfire throughout the city and school. When she got to Pax Institute the next day, everyone was obviously distracted. The teachers didn't fight it. They knew that they had history unfolding right before them all. It was the end of the Covenant, and that gave everyone in Paxopolis more than enough cause for celebration. At noon, the teachers gathered everyone in the dining hall to watch the incoming news feeds on a large screen that took up the top half of one of the hall's walls. The kitchen kept the students and faculty fed, while they watched everything transpire. In the few dull moments, the teachers stood up and gave context for what the students were seeing. Since she was close to the Arbiter and his clan, Kasha Hylot provided the lion's share of information, particularly from the perspective of the Sangheili people. For Molly, it was the most fascinating commentary she heard that day. To the humans inside Onyx, the destruction of the Covenant meant the end of what had become a somewhat distant threat. To Kasha and her kind, though, this marked an entirely new chapter for the Sangheili people. Things were about to change in big ways for all the people they had left behind in their keeps on Sanghelios. Once Molly got home, she found it hard to concentrate on her homework or even doing anything productive. In part, that was due to her lack of sleep, but she was also emotionally exhausted and filled with anxiety about what she'd seen the night before. The machine on Sanghelios, its threatening visage and massive angel of death wings hung in her mind, and she couldn't shake them out. What is it? Who activated it after 100,000 years? And perhaps the most worrying question for Molly: where did it go?
Chapter 21. That evening, as Molly was preparing for bed, Director Mendez came over to talk with her new parents. They ushered him into the living room to chat, and she once again sat at the top of the stairs and listened as hard as she could. Molly knew she wasn't supposed to, especially after getting caught last time,
But she needed more information. She had to know what was going on outside Onyx, and what her new parents were up to. So, one of your machines was buried on San Helios, Mendez said. How familiar are you with that one? Just what we know from the report, said Asha. It was underwater off the coast of Kifro, dormant for thousands of years. The Sangheili considered it a sacred site, which is why the city of Sonion even existed. Our contact says that the Sangheili weren't even aware the construct existed before the end of the war, and it's been inaccessible to researchers since then. The damn thing, Mendez continued, rose up, hovered there for a few hours, and then suddenly jumped into slipspace. They're calling it a guardian. Yes, we saw that on the feeds too, Young said. The question is, do we know where it went to? His voice was tinged with frustration and concern. Is there any way we can track it down? An active one like that? I'm afraid not, Mendez said flatly. First, the UNSC has already got people on its tail. But we don't know where it is exactly, and there's not much we can do from here. Secondly, that thing's location is not a matter of Onyx security. We're in a unique situation, being in this shell, Young. We can't afford to be distracted by what's going on out there, because if this shell goes, we can forget about being able to help anyone, especially if it winds up in the hands of our enemies. You two need to be focused on what we've got in our backyard, in case our own guardian follows suit. Have your people found the servants yet? It seems like more than a coincidence that these events are all happening at the same time, Asha said. Not yet. And we're not seeing any direct connection, said Mendez. There's more information that you two need, especially within the context of the Goliath scenario here on Onyx. All those other planets we've lost contact with recently, they each had a guardian on them, too, buried and then suddenly activated. The destruction on some of those worlds was catastrophic. Made the stuff you saw at Sonion look tame. What's the connection, then? Asha asked, also frustrated. Why are all of these coming online now? What's the source? It's hard for us to make any progress on these questions when we have little to no activity with our specimen here. But the rest of the galaxy's guardians are up and moving around. We need to be out there, Director. Hold up, ma'am. There's still more you need to hear. Captain Thomas Lasky of the UNSC Infinity, the ship that assisted the Arbiter in toppling what was left of the Covenant. He's shared with me some information that actually may help. Outside of a handful of people, you will be the first on Onyx to hear this. Mendez took a breath before he continued. Lasky believes that the activation of the Guardians is the work of a rampant AI named Cortana, a construct made by Dr. Catherine Halsey. Mendez swallowed hard. According to him, this AI is the one waking these Forerunner things up. Lasky and Halsey. Molly had heard both of those names before. Lasky's UNSC Infinity was the flagship of the entire UNSC fleet. The massive vessel stretched more than 5 kilometers long. Halsey was a prominent scientist, although much of her record lay shrouded in Oni red tape. News feeds Molly regularly scanned knew well enough of her and her background, but not necessarily what she worked on for Oni. The rumors of all kinds abounded. How is the Cortana AI, if that is really the source, managing that? Young said. We've been exploring these things for years now, and we've never seen any way to activate them locally, or even data on how they would operate if they were to come online. To be honest, I'm less worried about the how than the why, Mendez said. Halsey is currently working on a solution to the how issue, at least as far as Infinity is concerned. You're kidding, Asha said. Molly had never heard her voice so cold when talking about anyone else. Mendez chuckled softly. Trust me, you don't want me to get started about the doctor, but the bottom line is that she can't cut you out completely. At least not if I have anything to say about it. Since she made Cortana, She thinks of all of this as her problem, and to be honest, I'm not ready to disagree with her. As Cortana's creator, she probably knows best what it would take to stop her.
Now, Mendez took a deep breath. She'd be furious that I'm bringing you all this information. But that's not her call.